Welcome to the Iron Mind Podcast. Join me, Josh Brumley, as we explore the minds of those who forged their paths through legal battles, business triumphs, and creative conquests. In each episode, we sit down with inspiring individuals who've sharpened their resolve in the fires of entrepreneurship and law. From lawyers breaking barriers to entrepreneurs overcoming obstacles, we uncover the stories behind their iron wills and innovative minds. Get ready for thought-provoking conversations, practical insights, and actionable advice. This is the Iron Mind Podcast. Welcome to the show, Bruce Lamb.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. Could you take a moment to explain to our guests a little bit about your background and your path that led you to your legal career?
Sure. So I'm Bruce Lamb. I'm a teacher and a lawyer. Started out as the latter. I went to law school right out of my undergraduate days at the University of Washington. I decided to go to University of Oregon Law School, graduated in 1984. So fairly young. I got to try my first jury trial as a third-year law student.
Wow.
For the Lane County Public Defender's Office. It was a great thrill. Got an acquittal.
What was the charge?
Driving under the influence.
Nice.
And, much longer war story, of course. But I had clerked at firms in Eugene, Oregon. I decided to take a job at a Seattle firm. It was a defense litigation firm called Merrick, Hofstede, and Lindsay. So I had that job waiting for me when I got out of law school. I started there and I stayed for a long time. I stayed there about 25 years. Became a partner, shareholder, and did that for about 20 years. But I was kind of planning my escape from full-time law practice. Apologies to people who are still there. It was the fact that it was very business bottom line oriented, and it was the billable hour that over time became less inspiring to me. Mm. So I went back to school. I got a Master of Public Administration. I'd been doing a lot of volunteer work for nonprofit organizations, and I thought that might be a second career. I left full-time practice and did some work in the nonprofit sector, interim executive director, chief financial officer, things like that. And then kind of got an offer to teach a little bit. So I taught a class at Highline College. It was legal research and writing, Roman numeral one. and it kind of got its hooks in me. And I eventually taught two, three, and then full-time. And have been running the legal studies department at Highline College for about 5-6 years now. So it's a wonderful joy. The students are just infinitely inspiring. And they almost all get good jobs, thanks to lawyers like you.
Oh, well, thank you.
That's also, actually... I should mention along the way, one thing that kept me in the business longer, and it still fulfills me, is volunteer work for Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. So I'm mostly civil litigation, but I've also done a slice of immigration law for a long time. They trained me up to do political asylum, defense of asylum cases, meaning people that have had to flee their countries of origin. And have gotten here somehow or other, they have a defense to deportation if they can prove a well-founded fear of persecution if they're forced to return to their home country. So I do a few of those cases every year for almost 40 years.
Even now,
absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely now. And I should mention, I've gotten out of full-time civil litigation work. For years, after I left full-time practice, I continued to do some basically consulting. So I was working on civil cases, now mostly on the plaintiff side. So I was working in Oregon with some larger wrongful death cases, catastrophic injury cases, and have been an arbitrator for a long, long time. Yeah, still today.
Wow. And that's actually how we met, not your arbitration practice, but the Highline College practice during COVID. I reached out and said, hey, you guys got any gigs for a young attorney who wants to teach? And the rest is history. Now I'm a professor with you down there at Highline College.
And it's great to have you as part of the legal team.
I love being there. And so do you want to discuss a little bit about how you balance your role as an educator and an attorney, like what that life is like?
Well, I'm primarily an educator and a program manager. So, you know, we have other responsibilities. I love teaching, which is kind of my number one joy. But there's all these administrative things that come with the job I have now. And it's okay. I think about, well, it has to be done in order to be able to have students and teach. So it includes marketing our program and ensuring compliance with the ABA, which accredits our program. There's all kinds of outcome measurement and things like this, ensuring high quality adjunct instructors, for among other things. So there's that. There's the immigration cases that I always do some of, and then serving as an arbitrator. And as I said, I can't really think of any other pending cases I have anymore.
So you're not, you have no pending arbitrations or anything like that right now?
Well, I may have been appointed on a case, and I get appointed probably 5-6 times a year and have preside over 2-3 hearings a year.
And are those mostly personal injury cases, or they can be anything?
Almost exclusively personal injury cases.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. And if someone who's listening to this is interested in engaging with the Highline Paralegal Studies program, how can they find out more information?
Just give me a call.
You're going to give your phone number on the air here?
Well, sure, I'll give you my office number. But go to legal.highline.edu. That's all about our paralegal program. And my office number is 206-592-4628. Let me mention that if you're a practitioner with any staff that you think highly of but is not trained to do paralegal work yet, you know, considering how hard it is to find experienced, high-quality paralegal, consider instead sending your staff member to our program where they can get trained up while they continue to work for you, and then continue to add higher value as they learn all the paralegal roles.
Wonderful idea. Wonderful idea. Can you discuss just briefly the evolution and what you perceive as the potential future of personal injury and motor vehicle accidents, how the law has changed over time in your years of practice?
Well, when I started, we used to try cases.
That shouldn't be funny. That shouldn't be
well,
funny.
Well, I mean, it shouldn't be. And so it's evolved into a work it up and settle, or MAR. So my observation is that over time, practitioners' litigation skills, I'll say overall, are diminished. And it's not through fault. It's through what they have to do every day from day to day. So, you know, I tried more cases in my first, you know, 5-10 years of practice than I did in the whole rest of my years of practice.
Oh, wow.
So we used to be able to go and try a small injury case, for example, pick a jury and try a case. That almost never happens anymore, I don't think. There's some appeals from arbitrations, and I often wonder why there aren't more. If I hear somebody saying, well, they really got a low ball result from an arbitrator, it's like, well, go ahead, take it up. Or
de novo it.
Yeah. Or carriers especially. I mean, gosh, if you're so confident in your offer, however low it was, stand by it. Go try the case. And in which case, you guys should have a chance to get your actual fees. So anyway, that's my 2 cents. Less trial work over time.
Why do you think that is?
Well, the rules have changed. For one thing, there was mandatory arbitration was just the dawn of arbitration when I started practicing, which was in 1984. Okay. Our mandatory arbitration came along, and that was originally $25,000.
Oh, wow. You
know, now it's $100,000 most places, I think.
Yep.
So more and more cases are subject to arbitration. The other thing that happened is the courts have adopted mandatory ADR before you can come and try a case. So that was not the case originally. You could just, you know, you had a trial date. After losing 2 or 3 of them because the judge had multiple cases booked, you'd eventually get to try your case. They have a better calendaring system now, I think, although it doesn't always work out. You still end up with contingencies you weren't hoping for. But anyway, that's a few things. Future, I don't know. I mean, somebody like you could probably tell me more. I mean, I know AI is going to be used more and more by firms. And my hope, since I am training paralegals now, is that it'll initially maybe help increase the value of paralegals who are more nimble with technology than the lawyers they're going to work for.
Than us old timers. We're just the gray-haired attorneys now, and do we get the young folks in here?
You seem to be pretty technologically savvy, but gosh knows...
I fake it well.
Gosh knows I'm not, and not too many people my age.
Well,
so anyway, hopefully AI will help in the short run. And who knows what, I mean, in the future, in the long run, right, it could adversely affect the number of, you know, openings for paralegals.
Legal professionals generally.
Definitely attorneys.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, judges. I mean, you know, you use your imagination.
Another component I think it's really cool to think about, COVID actually forced the court system to integrate Zoom, and Highline as well had to change with the times and go hybrid or completely virtual. Now, I think almost exactly to the day, 1 month from today, I have a Zoom jury trial for a personal injury case, and it'll be my first Zoom jury trial, and I'm not sure what that pandemonium is going to be like, but ask me again after it's over. I don't know if you have an opinion about that, but it seems scary to have jurors who can just be like doing other things on their phone and not really paying attention to the trial, who are in charge of making a determination about the outcome of the case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that, as you know, particularly having had the privilege of being in the courtroom with the jurors, the judge, opposing counsel, the witnesses. I would much prefer that if I'm going to try a case. On the other hand, it certainly makes a lot of sense in terms of time and money and resources to do what we're doing now. I remember being a juror or a prospective juror in the earlier days of COVID when they're just starting that. I was going to prospective juror on a criminal case. And I remember the judge chewing me out because he said, "Mr. Lamb, juror number whatever I was, you're not looking at your device. Is there someone else in the room?" And I thought, well, no, we're supposed to look away from our screens once in a while. But I look back on that going, oh, you know, it's probably the judge's first thing.
Too. Yeah.
How are you going to police jurors from not
looking seems at like their, a lot of work.
Looking at the screen?
A lot of work. I'll have more insight soon on that. But what about any tips or insights you have for people listening who are maybe either young attorneys butting into their practice as a personal injury professional in either the insurance defense side or plaintiff side, or a seasoned attorney who's interested in moving from a practice like immigration and getting more involved in this world of personal injury practice? Do you have any tips?
Well, I think you have to like what you're doing. I mean, this is not news. If you're a people person, you might be drawn to personal injury work. The greatest joy, and mind you, I was mostly on the defense side, but also when I was doing plaintiff's cases, was just to be able to walk alongside my client during a difficult time in their life, help them understand what's going on, try to make sure they have a clear lay of the land, and make sure they're making sound decisions. I try to always remind myself it's their case, not mine, especially as insurance defense. It's my client's case.
Yeah,
I work for them. I don't work for their insurer. And that gave me a lot of, I got a lot of joy out of that. You got to learn a lot about other people's jobs and their lives, and that was probably one of the greatest joys. So if that sounds appealing to you, you might be interested in personal injury work. I think you have to be careful about on the business side. So, you know, there's, sorry to say, there are a lot of people who do injury work, either a little or a lot. So you have to come up with a model that works, and if you're on the plaintiff's side, it'll have to be either of, you know, enough big cases or an awful lot of smaller cases, and in a way that you can keep those moving, and but still making sure you're doing the best job you can for all your clients.
Right. There's ethical implications when you're managing too many cases to do a good job or to do a bad job.
Well, that came up on the defense side, frankly. You know, when you're getting, you know, kind of suppressed compensation, you know, this insurer is getting more thoughtful about, well, let's see, how we got this volume of cases, you know, we get this range of outcomes, how can we kind of reduce things on the cost side? And so there were times when I would have to say, no, I can't not take a deposition. I'm defending my client. Thank you. And, you know, maybe the case is within the limits of their policy. Maybe it isn't. I've got to do everything I can to protect their interests. So I was pushing back against some pressure to do less.
And so for people who are not used to that dynamic, you'd say that from an insurance defense attorney standpoint, the insurance companies are mostly concerned with the reduction of costs. What, how can they resolve this case for the least amount of money?
Well, it makes sense for any business.
Right, right.
But that said, I mean, I worked with really good people in the insurance defense business and people with integrity and all that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
It was harder when it was a, you know, out-of-state insurer and you're, you know, dealing with time zone differences and hard to get anybody to communicate directly with you. But anyway, there was mostly good work. And then on the plaintiff side, of course, it was even more work with the client. And
right.
They would tend to be bigger cases, longer term cases. So that was quite interesting and challenging.
Well, with your background in both plaintiffs and defense work and your background as an educator, I thought you'd be a wonderful guest to discuss three different cases that I think every personal injury attorney should be aware of and understand when they apply. And those cases are Winters, Mahler, and Ham, and what their effects are on attorney's fees. So can you share what you'd like to share about those three cases?
Why don't we start with the basics that I understand, and then we'll see how far we want to go.
Okay,
I'll say, I'm not an expert, but I did live through the days before Winter, Ham, Mahler, Winter, and then Ham. And I understand what they are. I understand the basic holdings and the difference they make in cases. So starting from before those cases, you know, you had insurance companies. We're talking primarily about MedPay and PIP.
Right.
Benefits that are paid by an insurer to their first party insured. And then that insured in turn having a claim against third party or a UIM claim versus the same carrier, essentially. We're talking about first party insurance, insurer's right to reimbursement for benefits paid under first party insurer. And originally, the insurance companies would treat that as their claim. So we paid MedPay benefits to you. We'll take care of our own reimbursement, thank you. We're members of an intercompany arbitration agreement or something, and we don't want you
involved.
Attorney Brumley. we'll take care of our own interest here, thank you very much. Good luck with the general damages. Little by little, that was done away with. So the first case was Thuringer, so that's the full reimbursement rule. That there's no right of reimbursement. No insurer is going to get any money back unless and until the insured is fully compensated for their injuries. So there's lots of scenarios where you add up the PIP, the MedPay, the first-party health insurance, the liability limits, and the UI limits, if any, and it's well short of what the damages are. And we only know that for sure when there's an actual decision, arbitration or trial. But in a lot of cases, it's obvious, and you won't have a fight over it. But you can. So sometimes that issue, whether your client's been fully compensated, could be an issue for negotiation. But you start with that. And then the next question is, all right, I'm a first-party carrier. I'm a, I don't know, is PEMCO still writing?
Yeah.
Or whatever. I've paid my insured the 10K MedPay limits. Now they are pursuing recovery against, against a third-party tortfeasor who's insured by, you know,
Geico.
Farmers, Geico, okay, somebody else. If they recover from this third party, when and how much do I get back? So the short answer, Mahler deals with that situation. It's a first party pays MedPay or PIP or both, and then their insured recovers against a third party. And in that situation, Mahler said, okay, if the insured's fully compensated, like you pay 10K, they have a claim, it's determined to be worth $25,000, and the tortfeasor has $25,000 limits, well, now they can recover the full amount of your damages, and you've already got 10K in PIP, right?
Yeah.
So what happens? How much they would say, well, I get my 10K back. But Mahler says, no, no, you have to pay a pro rata share of your insured's
attorney's fees
in collecting that part of their claim. So it prohibited claim splitting as had been done in the pre-Mahler days. So I'm sorry, first party insurer, you can't peel off your med pay and say that's a separate claim. No, it's all part of your insured's claim. So they have an attorney, they have a fee agreement with the attorney. You have to basically honor that and make sure that that your insured isn't penalized by losing some of their recovery in attorney's fees. So that's the way it works. It is based on the actual fee agreement, you know, not on policy provisions don't come into play at all here. It's an equitable principle of right to reimbursement, subrogation. And so it's based on your fee agreement as the plaintiff's attorney, whether it's a third, it's not third. Some people think automatically a third could be 40%, whatever your
fee agreement
is. Yeah. So, I mean, that in a nutshell, that's Mahler. Winters involved situation where it was the plaintiff had both first party insurance benefits were paid. There was also third party liability insurance that was recovered, and there was benefits recovered. The court just basically said it's the same rule. So the fact that one insurer might be both first party pay both first party benefits and some UIM
benefits,
they still have to pay the pro rata share of the insured's attorney's fees. Wonderful. And then finally, HAM is the purely set one insurance company. So you have plaintiff injured by uninsured motorist, same carrier pays both first party benefits and UIM benefits. And that's when, you know, really got the insurers like, what do you mean? It's our money.
The attorney didn't do anything
for us. Well, they did. I mean, the rule is that basically we want to put both the insured and the insurance company in the same place, regardless of whether it so happens that the plaintiff was injured by a third party or by an underinsured motorist, by an uninsured motorist.
Yeah.
You say, no, State Farm, you're going to be in the same position, whether you pay both, whether you also UM or not, or whether it's third party, like everybody's going to get the same in all three scenarios.
I think that that's a wonderful way of describing this. I think, I've been in practice for a number of years now, and these concepts were incredibly difficult for me to grasp when I was a new attorney. And so I'm going to actually use my website once this podcast is released to have calculators that people can use. Obviously, we don't verify any of that. You got to make sure you're using the right numbers. But I want to create tools for people to use on the website to help with your guidance here of the understanding of when these cases apply, to be able to calculate these benefits and then use that information to negotiate with the insurance companies. I think it's super beneficial. I think there's not enough education about when these apply, and sometimes reading the case law doesn't make it incredibly clear. So thank you very much for those descriptions of when they apply. Do you have any wisdom or advice for newcomers or aspiring personal injury lawyers?
Wow. I mean, I not a lot more than I said already.
That's okay.
I don't know. You got to like what you do, and you got to have a plan that's going to make economic sense for you. Oh, there's one other thing. I'll say this for everybody in every job. Don't be trapped. Don't be in the position where you have a job. It compensates you a certain amount. Maybe not as much as you want, but where it's your only option in life. You don't want to feel like, oh my gosh, this is killing me, but I have to keep doing it.
Right.
Always, always, always be thinking about a plan B. I mean, most if you've passed the bar exam, you know, you have something of value, and there's different ways you can use it in life. And there's a lot of places in the world that need your training and experience, and there's ways you can apply that. So don't feel trapped in what you're doing. For gosh sake, don't acquire debts that are going to make you feel like there's nothing else you can do in the world. Don't get addicted to a certain lifestyle that ties you to a job. Have options. Then you'll never feel, you know, you won't have that terrible feeling of, oh my gosh,
I gotta stay in this role that I'm not passionate about because I settled on this career choice and now I'm too in debt or too tied into this career to make a change.
Correct.
Don't settle.
Well,
chase your passion.
Well, you know, gosh, I mean, it's easy to say, but honestly, especially earlier in your career, you can always be thinking about, well, you know, there's other things I can do. If you do say the same thing, pretty soon that's the thing that will be you'll be compensated the most for. Oh my gosh, do you ever do product liability cases against auto manufacturers? Then you're the go-to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, over time, then maybe that's all you know or all you think you're good at. You know, maybe think about some other things along the way.
That's great advice. Great advice. Do you have any stories that you'd like to share of your practice of law that you think might be anecdotal or a moral of a story that helps a new attorney to be a better practitioner? Anytime a judge has ever yelled at you that comes to mind? Probably never. You seem pretty put together guy. So,
oh, I mean, there's a bunch of them. I mean, you gotta be ethical. You gotta do the right thing, and there are temptations to not. So these are little things, but I remember a client, getting ready for a deposition. We've all had the talk now. Got to answer all the questions. Got to be honest. Got to tell the truth. Now, you don't have to answer anything that they don't ask you, but if they ask you a question, you got to answer it honestly, right? Right. So one particular client, he had showed me some photographs that involved the accident scene that I didn't know about. He showed it to me right before the deposition. I said, okay, these are great. They haven't asked for photos or anything yet, but you know, if they ask about them, you got to be sure to tell them. And for some reason, this case, it was about the third question in the deposition. What's your name? Where do you live? Do you have any photographs? And darned if the client didn't say no.
Oh, no.
I was just stunned, you know? So I said, excuse me, we're going to have a break before the next question.
You had to slap him around.
I had to have a lecture and have him go back in and
correct his testimony.
I mean, little things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think everybody has a story of a client who doesn't always listen to directions. But, you know, if there are any clients listening to this, like, we know what we're asking you to do. We understand the implications of what we're asking you to do. Please follow our advice. It's what you're paying us to give you. That's the benefit of having an attorney. And we understand how a photo might hurt or help us, but it's much more damning if you don't disclose it and then they find it. It's pretty detrimental. That's a great one. Gosh, that brought something else to my mind, and now I'm...
Well, one other thing that came up during practice was, the matter of answering interrogatories. So during the height, well, when I was in the middle of the litigation practice, you know, I would say there was some sharp practice in answering interrogatories. In other words, if somebody drafted a question poorly, your obligation was to just answer it the way it was put.
What you thought that they meant.
Not what you thought that they meant until, as you know, the Faison's case came along. And read the Faison's versus Physicians Insurance Exchange. I would say it didn't send a shudder. It certainly was kind of a wake-up call for litigators. I think probably on both sides, but certainly defense counsel. And, you know, it involved questions that asked about a particular brand name product. And the defense answered the question correctly if the question was limited to the brand name of the product.
Not the general product.
The defendant knew full well that what the plaintiff was interested in was the active ingredient in the product.
Mm.
And by not answering or indicating that it was answering so narrowly, it ended up becoming a very, very big deal later and cost the manufacturer dearly. Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, Professor Bruce Lamb, everybody. I really appreciate it. In closing, I want to ask you one thing. What does being an iron mind attorney mean to you?
Well, I think it means an attorney who's resourceful, resilient, and doesn't get too, doesn't buckle to pressure, has some poise maybe. There was a trial I had as a young attorney, and I don't claim to be an iron mind attorney. I'm just as fallible and as everybody else. But as a young attorney, I was asked to take on a case and try it 2 weeks before, a federal court trial, jury trial. And another attorney had worked it up very well. But during the case, one of the issues was whether or not a certain event had taken place when the plaintiff was arrested. It was basically a 1983 false arrest case. And it was a she said case where you had a jail matron who said, I did the intake and we didn't do this thing to the plaintiff. And you have the plaintiff say, oh, yes, they did. And it was bad. Well, after the testimony from both sides, in the middle of the trial, the plaintiff's attorney, very good attorney, said, you know, I have a new witness we're going to call tomorrow.
Uh-oh.
I said, well, who is it? And they just gave me the name. I'd never heard of him. I go, who are they? They were there when the plaintiff was checked in by the matron. I said, oh, my gosh, you know.
Valuable testimony here.
I thought, oh, my goodness. Well, so I didn't have any great days, but I immediately told my paralegal, just find out anything you can, please, about this. Check the criminal records.
You got 24 hours before this person's in trial with you.
Well, so not me, but a very resourceful paralegal, experienced paralegal, was able to find out that this witness had a criminal conviction in Snohomish County for first-degree murder. And got me a certified copy of the conviction by the time it was time for me to cross-examine the witness. And it was a very dramatic moment.
Like a movie.
The witness was actually dying of cancer as well.
Wow.
So this independent witness comes in with a cane and goes up and swears to tell the truth and says, my witness, the matron, is a liar. And I just had one question. Cross-examination. Thanks to my very resourceful paralegal. So maybe my paralegal was an iron mind.
That's a great anecdote. And now you teach all your paralegals in the program how to be that successful.
Be ready
for anything. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Lamb. Highline College Paralegal Program. Please check it out if you're interested in a career as a legal professional without going to law school. You can go through the paralegal program at Highline. You'll meet Bruce Lamb in person. You might even have me as a professor. It's up to Bruce after this. He might still want me to teach. I don't know.
Let me add to an earlier comment that if you have any questions about the application of Mahler, Winters, or Ham in any particular case, I would suggest that Josh Brumley, or Professor Brumley, as we call you, would be a good person to consult.
And one more time, in closing, what's the website for people to apply for the Highline College Paralegal Program?
Yeah, so it would be www.highline.edu. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and other social media.
Awesome. Thank you very much.